Welcome to the Space Show, Robert.
Thanks for inviting me.
Now, you're well known as an advocate for sending humans to Mars. Why should we go to Mars?
Well, I think there's three reasons to go to Mars, for the science, for the challenge, for the future. Mars, you know, was cold and dry today, but it was once a warm and wet planet. It had liquid water on it for a period of 1 billion years, which is five times as long as it took life to appear on Earth after there was liquid water here. And so if the theory is correct that life will develop from chemistry wherever you have appropriate physical and chemical conditions and reasonable temperatures, water, then life should have appeared on Mars, even if it subsequently went extinct when conditions on the planet deteriorated. And if we can go to Mars and find fossils of past life on the surface, we'll have proven that the development of life is a general phenomenon in the universe. And since we now know that planets are everywhere, and every star has a zone near or far from it, depending on the brightness of the star, where you have the right kind of temperatures for liquid water. If life develops wherever it has a decent planet, it means life's everywhere. And since the whole history of life on Earth is one of development from simpler forms to more complex forms with greater capacities for activity and intelligence and ever more rapid evolution, if life's everywhere, it means intelligence is everywhere. It means we're not alone. This is something that thinking men and women have wondered about for thousands of years, and we can resolve it by going to Mars. Now, furthermore, if we go to Mars and we can drill down into the ground and reach the liquid groundwater, there could be life in it today. And we could look at that life and see if it has the same biochemistry as Earth life, and if it does or if it doesn't. And you know, all Earth life has the same biochemistry. It all uses the same amino acids, the same method of replicating and transmitting information from one generation to the next via RNA and DNA. Does life have to be that way, or could there be other arrangements altogether? In other words, are we the Earth life? Are we what life is, or are we just one peculiar example drawn from a much vaster tapestry of possibilities? This is worth finding out. We're going to find it out by going to Mars. Now, the second is the challenge. I think that civilizations are like individuals. We grow when we challenge ourselves. We stagnate when we do not. And a Humans to Mars program would be a tremendous, bracing, positive challenge for every country that engaged in it. It would say to the young people, learn your science, and you could be explorers of new worlds. And out of that challenge, we'd get millions of young scientists, engineers, inventors, doctors, medical researchers, technological entrepreneurs. These are the kinds of people that move society forward. Okay, this is what moves society forward, is intellectual capital. Developed intellectual capital, and we would get it in massive amounts by mobilizing it, inspiring it with a Humans to Mars program. And finally, there is the future. You know, what are we doing today that is going to matter to the future? What are we doing today that people 500 years from now are going to care about? Are they going to care which group of lunatics and fanatics got into power in Syria or Yemen? Okay, no. Are they going to care which group of corrupt politicians got in power, stayed in power for an extra year or two in this cabinet or that cabinet? No. Okay, but what we do to make their civilization possible, a civilization that will extend humanity not just to Mars and other places in our solar system, but across vast reaches of space to thousands of planets orbiting thousands of stars in this reach of the galaxy. What we did to make that possible, that's what will count. This time will be remembered because this is when we first set sail for other worlds.
Should we be doing an Apollo style just a couple of days there? Or, you know, you talk about drilling down. This is going to take a long time. So are you looking towards permanent habitation?
I believe the best way to do it is with initial missions that are long duration exploration missions that... The flight plan I prefer is known as the conjunction flight time flight plan, which is 6 months out, year and a half on the Martian surface, 6 months back. There's an alternative plan, which is about 2 years out and back in unequal legs and 1 month at Mars. I don't think that's productive because you're right. If you're going to explore seriously, it takes time. We don't want to do flags and footprints. We want to do some serious reconnaissance expeditions. But I do believe these first missions should be round-trip missions. They should eventually be followed by settlement missions. But before you launch your settlement, you want to do some reconnaissance.
Now, you're famous for a plan called Mars Direct. What were the origins of that?
Well, the origins of Mars Direct was a response to the failure of NASA's response to the first President Bush's call for a space exploration initiative. 1989 was the 20th anniversary of the Apollo moon landing. So the first President Bush got up on the steps of the Air and Space Museum with the Apollo 11 crew, Armstrong, Aldrin, Collins. He said, "This is the 20th anniversary of Apollo. That was great. That's what America's all about. And therefore, I, as president, am committing the nation to go back to the moon, on to Mars, this time to stay." And so with that kind of presidential imperative, what did NASA do? They decided to not accomplish that mission, but rather use that imperative as a justification for getting funds for every miscellaneous technology program they had an interest in getting funded. So they designed the most complex, ridiculous Mars mission plan one could possibly design in order to make every conceivable technology program mission critical and get them funded. And so they came out with a Mars mission plan that took 30 years to get there and cost $400 billion and was a drop-dead program killer in Congress because it was stupid. And so what we did, I was at the Martin Company at that time, Martin Marietta, who's now Lockheed Martin. And we said, look, if this is the approach taken, there isn't going to be a space exploration initiative. The only way Congress is going to fund humans to Mars is if someone shows them a more efficient way to do it. And so we have to go to a minimum cost, minimum time program. And so we designed Mars Direct with that in mind. I mean, you know, for NASA, the purpose of the Moon Mars initiative was to spend money. It's like running a business in order to fund your vendors. If you run a business, you may need some vendors, but you want to have as few as possible and pay them as little as possible. You don't run your business as a charity operation to fund a whole bunch of vendors. Okay.
So in short, the thing was just going to be too expensive.
Well, the 90-day report with the NASA plan was wildly expensive and also wildly time-consuming. It was unacceptable. So we designed a plan called Mars Direct. And there were two meanings to the word. One is that it was a direct programmatic approach without detours, and the other was that it was a direct flight approach. That is, we did not have on-orbit assembly in Earth orbit. We did not have lunar bases involved, you know, or L2 space stations, or any of the other pieces of infrastructure that someone might throw in the way of a Mars mission.
How was your plan received by VISTA or NASA?
Well, the plan, amazingly, was received quite well, at first. First of all, the Mars Direct plan was radical. We did a humans to Mars mission without on-orbit assembly of giant spaceships, which was considered to be the paradigm of how one would do it. It's how Wernher von Braun proposed to do it. We did humans to Mars with two direct flights to Mars of a Saturn V class vehicle. The first to send an Earth return vehicle, which would then make its propellant out of the Martian atmosphere using well-known chemical engineering techniques. And then you shoot out a Habitat spacecraft, relatively small spacecraft with a crew of four astronauts in it, that would land near the Earth return vehicle, operate on the surface there for a year and a half, and then the crew leaves the Hab behind and comes back in the Earth return vehicle. Every time you do this, you add another Habitat to the base. Before you know it, you've got the beginnings of a human settlement on a new world. This was a totally different way of thinking about it. Mars Direct was primarily designed by myself and another engineer named David Baker. And Baker and I went down to the Marshall Space Flight Center, Huntsville, and we were expecting a totally negative reception. And instead, we got an overwhelmingly positive reception. Despite the fact that Marshall was the most conservative space center in NASA. In fact, I think precisely because they were. Because they saw all these plans for building giant spaceships at orbiting spaceports, and that to them said science fiction. Okay? They saw our plan, I said, this is Apollo times two. This is something we could do. We could actually do this. Okay? So they were pretty excited about it. And then they sent us over to Johnson Space Center and telling us who all the right people to talk to were and who what buttons to push and how to present it. And that went pretty well too. But we had a number of good presentations, and then there was a counterattack. because the people in the space station program felt that we were de-justifying them. That is, at that time, they were selling the space station as you need to have a space station to have an orbiting spaceport on which to assemble giant interplanetary spaceships. And we said, you don't need to assemble giant interplanetary spaceships. Now, we didn't talk about the space station at all. We didn't attack it directly, but clearly the implication was you don't need it. And so they got upset, and they told people to back away from us. And so we became quite controversial, and we've remained controversial ever since. Because, once again, if you have a program that is designed to be lean and mean and gets to Mars with only a small subset of the technologies that NASA is sponsoring, all the ones you're not using are going to hate you.
Now, some of the ideas that you put forward have been taken up recently by NASA, haven't they? For example, there's a rover going to Mars in 2020, which is going to test out some of the technologies you've been suggesting.
Yeah, that's correct. There's two chemical reaction systems that we proposed as part of the Mars Direct Plan to make rocket propellant on Mars. One makes methane and oxygen by reacting hydrogen with the Martian atmosphere. The other makes oxygen directly by splitting CO2 into carbon monoxide, which is disposed of, and oxygen, which is kept. And the latter reaction will be demonstrated on Mars, on the Mars 2020 rover. The first reaction has been demonstrated on Earth in various test systems, including at my lab and as well as others. But yes, we're going to demonstrate one of the two primary reactions of Mars Direct on Mars in 2020.
Now, since you proposed Mars Direct, a number of programs have come and gone in NASA. For example, Constellation. What was Constellation, and what was your view of it?
Well, Constellation was a program to build a set of hardware elements to allow lunar missions to occur. That is, in 2004, the second President Bush got up and said, I want to go back to the moon, on to Mars, it's time to stay. There were certain compromises made with the current NASA bureaucracy that turned out to be fatal, which were that, yes, we're going to do that, but for now we're going to focus on just building the space station, and after 2010 we'll focus on this, and therefore serious development was deferred, and as a result, when Obama came in, not much had been done, and he was able to cancel it. But that said, what Administrator Griffin did came in about a year after Bush's announcement. He said, okay, we're going to focus, this is Moon, Mars, and beyond. I don't know about Mars. We're going to at least make the first part of that happen. We're going to the moon. And they had NASA design a set of hardware to do that. Now, that was interesting. Even though I disagreed with his sole focus on the moon, at least it was a real plan, which unfortunately NASA lacks right now. That is, NASA's human spaceflight program today is operating without a plan. They are not executing a plan. They are building things that do not fit together and which therefore collectively don't represent any capability to do anything. Whereas what Griffin was trying to do was use the Apollo approach, where what happens is the first thing is you define the mission, then you define a plan to execute the mission, then you build the hardware elements required to implement that plan. That is intelligent. Okay, the way NASA's operating right now is they've got an SLS program that's developing a rocket without anything for it to launch, you know, which is crazy. We didn't develop the Saturn V without anything for it to launch, and we didn't develop a lunar ascent and descent vehicle without anything to get it to the moon with. I mean, so Griffin went back. What Constellation was an attempt to recover the effective Apollo methodology. Now, unfortunately, it got canceled, and NASA is now disorganized again. But, you know, here's what I basically say. You know, I thought Griffin's plan was wrong, but at least it was a plan. Right now, NASA doesn't have a plan, and so it's not even wrong, to quote, you know, Richard Feynman, who derided a particularly.
It seems crazy to me to build a rocket, huge rocket, the Space Launch System, and only have one mission every year or 2 years for it. And as far as I can see, the only defined mission for it at the moment is the asteroid retrieval mission. What do you think of that mission?
Well, the asteroid retrieval mission is crazy. Well, first of all, okay, when Obama dismantled Constellation and the Moon program, he did offer something to take its place, which was the idea that we would send missions to the near-Earth asteroids. Okay, so this had the downside of derailing a program that was reasonably well-organized and going somewhere, but it then offered something else. And Obama was pretty explicit. I forget the exact words, but what he said was, look, we shouldn't go back to the moon. It's time to go beyond the moon. It's time to go out into the solar system. You know, he didn't use these words, but basically he was saying, let's get out of harbor and let's go into the open ocean of space. And by going to near-Earth asteroids, we would be, you know, sort of going halfway to Mars, as it were. We'd be getting out there. Okay. And okay, that has a certain benefit to it, okay? Fine. But what NASA then did was they sabotaged that. They said, well, you want to see asteroids, but we don't want to go out of Earth-centered space. So what we'll do is we'll send a robotic craft out into the solar system to grab a small chunk of an asteroid, bring it back to lunar orbit, and we'll visit it there. And that way we'll be able to visit asteroid chunks without ever leaving our neighborhood. Okay, which directly undermined the principal thrust of Obama's initiative. Okay, so now, I mean, this, first of all, there's an issue here whether this is even feasible, because they want to recover a boulder-sized asteroid, which is like 3 meters in diameter and has a mass of about 500 tons. Now, if this is a free-floating body, A, it will be difficult to detect, but assuming you can do that, it'll probably be tumbling. And they want to tow this thing back to Earth orbit with an electric propulsion spaceship. How are you going to do that? This thing is a 500-ton boulder that's tumbling around in space. Are you going to lasso it and try to tow it with electric thrusters, which they have very high fuel efficiency but very weak thrust, very gentle push. You have to push for months on end in order to get anything going anywhere. Doesn't seem to work. Okay, say, well, what if we send this craft to an actual near-Earth asteroid and try to mine a boulder out of it and then tow it away? I mean, this is just beyond the technical capabilities of NASA. So there's an issue of whether this is even feasible. But assuming it is, it's still just stupid, because you're not accomplishing the goal of having human beings fly out into the solar system. Instead, and you're not exploring asteroids in any significant way. You're exploring rocks. You know, I mean, it would make just as much sense to take chunks of asteroids that we have in museums right now on Earth, okay, which are called meteors, and launch them into low Earth orbit so we could visit them there. You know, this is crazy. This is not space exploration. And it has nothing to do with in-situ resource utilization. If you want to do in-situ resource utilization, you want to do it at the destination you're going to. If you have a moon base, you want to do in-situ resource utilization on the moon. If you have a Mars base, you want to do it on Mars. You don't want to do it on some rock that's going around the moon in a retrograde orbit and as a different... Anyway, it's just silly. It has nothing to do with planetary defense, because electric propulsion systems are gentle, very gentle pushers. And if you want to do, you know, if we see an asteroid coming at the Earth, we want to give it an impulsive shove, which would be done with a missile, with either very high explosives or even a nuclear warhead. And you'd want to do it as far out away from the Earth as you can, because, presumably even in the outer solar system, because the further away it is, the less of a push you need to get it to miss. So it's not about planetary defense. It's not about human exploration. It's not about in-situ resources. If you want to do science, you'd be better off doing it with small robotic probes. So this mission is totally pointless. And it's crazy. Now, as far as the SLS is concerned, you can't justify the SLS program on the basis of this mission, even if this was a good mission. Doing this whole booster just to do this one mission is crazy. The SLS, the problem with the SLS, it's a booster being done outside the context of either a human moon or Mars or asteroid exploration program that needs it. If you have something like the SLS, you don't want to be launching it once every 4 years, as they're currently discussing. That's ridiculous. In other words, just to maintain it as a capability, it takes about $3 billion a year to have the workforce there. So if you launch it once every 4 years, you're paying $12 billion a launch. If you launch it once a year, you're paying $3 billion a launch, because to first approximation, the actual cost of the components of the rocket are in the noise. If you launch it three times a year, then you're paying $1 billion a launch. Okay, which is now beginning to make sense. So if you have an SLS program, you'd want to be launching it several times a year and supporting human expeditions to the moon and Mars as an ongoing program. But that means you have to build the rest of the hardware set to accomplish at least one of those principal missions.
Former astronaut Franklin Chang Dias, he's been on the space show several years ago, advocating nuclear electric propulsion. Now, is this a viable technology to get humans to Mars in either short term or long term?
No. What Chang Dias has been doing has been quite pernicious, not because he's been pushing his technology. I'll grant him the right to seek funding for his technology. And he's not using that much of the funding that's available. So that's not the problem here at all. The problem is that he's been going around saying we can't go to Mars until we have his technology because, oh, there's all these cosmic rays and there's zero gravity and there's no other answer than to build giant nuclear electric spaceships powered by his Vasimir engine. In other words, you can't do your program until you do my program. And what he's been doing is presenting an argument for the impossibility of humans to Mars that has been latched onto by people who don't want to do humans to Mars. And they say, you see, you can't do humans to Mars until we have the Vasimir warp drive, and so forget it. Or, okay, we're fine with doing humans to Mars as soon as you have the Vasimir warp drive, so we'll fund that a few million a year, and you see, we're working on it. And when we're ready, we'll let you know. But in the meantime, we're not going anywhere. Now, the fact of the matter is that, number one, we don't need to get to Mars in 39 days or anything of this sort to get there safely. We can take six-month voyages to Mars, which you can do with present-day propulsion. And the radiation doses are acceptable, and the zero-gravity doses are also acceptable. They're the same as what we experience on the space station every rotation. And if you wanted to, you could actually rotate the spacecraft and not have zero-gravity at all. So there's that. So we don't need the Vasimir to do it. And secondly, if you use realistic numbers for the weights of the nuclear electric power system, it does not enable quick trips to Mars. In fact, while we can get to Mars in 6 months with chemical propulsion, a realistic estimate of the flight time to Mars with a nuclear electric system is 3 to 5 years. So electric propulsion, not high-power electric propulsion, as Chang Dias pushes, but low-power electric propulsion, where you take your time, but you use the high exhaust velocity of an ion drive, you could get cargo payloads to Mars on the slow shipping route, but more efficiently in terms of the amount of propellant needed to get them there. And that's always been understood as a potential use, not an enabling role for electric propulsion, but an enhancing role. Okay, but this idea that we'll have super high-powered nuclear reactors that don't weigh anything, and therefore if you attach them to Vasimir drives, you can get to Mars in no time, is false and unnecessary.
Now, recently, an organization called Mars One has announced ambitious plans for private enterprise settlement of Mars. Now, what obstacles would they need to overcome in order to succeed? And is there any prospect that they might do that?
Well, the primary obstacle they need to overcome is lack of money. Let me say a few things in defense of Mars One, and then I will offer my criticism. Okay. First of all, it is a slander of Mars One that they are proposing a suicide mission. Okay, a one-way mission. Sounds like a suicide mission. No, it's a settlement mission. It's the same kind of mission that people took when they moved from England to Australia or England to America. You know, it's why we're here. Somebody took a one-way mission at some point in the past. And for my sake, for my part as an American, I'm really glad that my folks left Russia for America and didn't go back. Definitely. Okay. So, it's a one-way mission. It's a settlement mission, which is, in fact, the most productive kind of mission, most productive of exploration, and obviously by far the most productive for the deepest reasons of going to Mars, which is to create new branches of human civilization. We must do settlement missions if we're going to accomplish that. Okay. Now, also, it should be said that the one-way mission is simpler than the round-trip mission. You don't need to do the return flight. You don't need to develop all the return flight hardware. You don't need to deliver the return flight hardware to Mars. You don't need to pay for it, and you don't need to accept the risk of the return flight as an operation. Okay, all that's out of the picture. And so that's all to the good. But if you're going to Mars one way, and this is not going to be a suicide mission, but a settlement mission, which is the only valid way to do this, the only ethical way, the only intelligent way, is you don't just send one crew to Mars and say, okay, you're on Mars, you know, we wish you well. No, you send them to Mars and then you reinforce them with more people, more equipment, more supplies, and more people and more supplies. It's the Normandy Beach approach, okay? You're landing with the intent not just to make a beachhead, but to take the continent, you're going to take the world. Okay, and so you don't go to Mars with just enough funding for one mission. You have to have put together a logistical organization that has the wherewithal to keep raising funds and keep sending missions and sending more people and more of everything to back those people up for decades. Now, that's not impossible if you look at the most profound and daring or some of the most profound and daring settlement episodes in human history, such as the Pilgrims going to Massachusetts, or the Mormons going to Utah, or the Jews going to Palestine in the 20th century. What you see is in each of those cases, the people who actually went were backed up by very extensive home front organizations that raised the funds to pay for and supply and equip the people who actually went. Okay, and that was very wise of those people to do it that way. And it worked. Well, that's what you need here. You know, Mars One proposes to fund this with a reality TV show. I don't think that's remotely credible. I don't think that's even credible for funding one mission to Mars. Even if you accept, and I actually do accept, Bas Lohnsdorf estimates that if done in the private world and we're only going one way, we could send a mission to Mars for $5 billion, not the 50 of Mars Direct or the 200 of NASA, okay? But in other words, billions of dollars, not tens of billions, let alone hundreds of billions. Still, he doesn't have billions, and you're not going to get billions from a reality TV show. And furthermore, whatever you do get from a reality TV show, let's say you could raise $20, $30 million. That would be a rather successful show. Okay, first of all, that's much too much, little even for one mission. And second of all, it's unlikely to keep up that rate of profit on the second, third, fourth, seventh, eighth, 12th mission when it's no longer so exciting. What Mars needs, if you're going to do one-way settlement in the private sector, is we need a global Mars settlement support organization. Okay, you know, it doesn't need what Mars settlement needs is not a reality TV show. It needs a Theodore Herzl. That's what it needs. And perhaps someday we'll get it. Perhaps Mars One will realize that that's what it needs and attempt to organize that. The question of whether they have the capability of organizing that is, wide open. What one has reason to think that it would be quite a long shot. On the other hand, it's not an impossible thing, and I think someday someone will do it, because we got 7 billion people on the planet. About a billion of them live in the advanced sector, countries like America, Australia, Japan, Europe, where people have money, okay? And at least 10% of those people think it is essential to a positive human future that humans expand into space. So 10% of a billion people, 100 million people. 100 million people times $100 a year would be $10 billion a year. That absolutely would be enough to finance the private colonization of Mars. So it's a question of pulling those people together. someday somebody's going to come along with the material resources and the talent and the intelligence and the connections, the poise and all the rest to pull that together, and it'll happen.
Outside of the space community, where do you see the American public sitting on this?
Well, the American public is actually pretty pro-space. When I give a talk on the Mars Direct mission to a popular audience, not just a space audience, which is, you know, rigged in my favor, but just to a businessman's group, a plumber's convention, the main question I get is, how come we're not doing this? This is the sort of thing this country ought to be doing. Americans very much have a sense of themselves as a nation of pioneers, and when they see us moving away from that, when they see our politicians moving away from that, that they actually do not want to accept that. They actually feel a sense of betrayal that our political leadership seems to have accepted the idea that we've moved into some kind of age of limits, that we can no longer accept risk, that, you know, we've come to the end of our great days, that we're now a people whose great deeds can be found out about in museums but not in newspapers. They don't buy it. They don't want it. I think that if a politician were to get up and sound this trumpet loud and clear, they'd have plenty of support.
Now, Apollo was fueled by political and military considerations. Will America ever make a commitment to Mars for reasons of exploration alone?
Well, will we go to Mars for exploration alone? I'd say probably not. Exploration will figure into it, but human motives will always be mixed. Okay, there'll always be different people supporting it for their own reasons. There were people who supported Apollo for scientific reasons. There were people who supported Apollo for reasons associated with the Cold War. There were people who supported Apollo because they thought it was the first step in human expansion into space and settlement. You know, all sorts of people. And there were people who supported Apollo because they were getting contracts to build stuff for it. You know, I mean, human motives are always across the map. Now, if we talk about Mars, why might we go to Mars? Well, of course, it all depends who's doing it, whether you're talking about it being done privately or by the government. If we're talking about the government doing it, I mean, one obvious possibility is that we are, in fact, or apparently, moving into a new Cold War right now with the Russians. And we, you know, and here you've got Putin saying, you know, you guys are the past, we're the future, you're decadent, blah, blah. You know, maybe it's time that we need to, once again, astound the world with the great deeds that free people can do. So there's something to be said for that. There's another argument altogether, which is we appear to be moving into a Cold War and we need to reverse this trend before it gets too dangerous, and a Humans to Mars program done together with the Russians might be a way to abort the deterioration of international relations and try to bring the world back together again. Okay, that's another viewpoint. That, for instance, was how Carl Sagan saw things with his proposals for a Humans to Mars program. There may be people who go to Mars because they think they've got a business plan that'll work. You know, the initial colonists that went to Virginia and Massachusetts in America went looking for gold. Now, there wasn't any gold there, but in different ways they found ability to live there. And in Virginia they found tobacco, and in New England they found fisheries and shipbuilding, and then they proceeded to build a culture which was viable in its own right, not just as a commercial base for trying to make profit for English entrepreneurs, and you took it from there. Of course, the real benefit of those colonies, or to even go back further, the Columbus voyage, which was financed in the hope of finding a spice route to India, which it did not, but what it did do was open up the Americas to Western civilization, and it greatly accelerated the development of Western civilization as a worldwide maritime civilization, which therefore also eventually resulted in Australia being developed. You had new branches of civilization develop, which had all kinds of productions, ranging from new forms of government, new technologies, literatures, histories of heroic deeds that will inspire people not only in the present age, but for millennia into the future. And I think that all these things will play into the decision to go to Mars.
Why does this generation have to be the one to do it? Why us? Why now?
Well, if not us, then who? And if not now, then when? I mean, I think there is a significant danger here that at this point, a few of the Apollo generation are still around. Very few of them are still working, but some of them are around in retirement. You can still meet Buzz Aldrin. You can, and other people who were significant players, let alone larger numbers whose names are not famous, but who nevertheless absolutely took part. And there are these people around who can remember the time when we did things like this and got it done, when we did things despite the fact that we knew they were risky, but we decided we were going to do it, and we did it. Okay, we didn't go to the moon. You know, Kennedy didn't say in 1961, I think this country should go to the moon, but we should wait until we know we can do it safely, and so perhaps sometime in the future this will happen. No, he said, I'm committing the nation to be on the moon before the end of this decade. Okay, we're going to figure this out. We're going to do it. Okay, we're going to put both our intellect and our valor to the test and do great things, because that's the kind of people we are. Okay. And we did. And now you have a safety-obsessed culture that is, at least its bureaucracies are increasingly incapable of accepting risk to undertake great projects. You know, I mean, really, under the present political ethos, would the settlement of either Australia or North America have been possible? Could anyone have authorized the Lewis and Clark expedition of sending a small group of men across North America on foot in 1803? I mean, anything could have happened to them. Who could guarantee their safety? You know, et cetera. Who could have guaranteed Columbus's safety? And if we become the kind of culture that for whom these sorts of deeds are consigned to almost a mythical past in which there were heroic people who could do things like that, but we are not like that anymore, then we are accepting a form of cultural decline that would be far more devastating to us and far more costly to us than anything that any kind of space program might cost. Yeah, so anyway, if people want to find out more about what I've got to say about this and how I think a Mars mission and a Mars settlement could be done, I've written a book on the subject called The Case for Mars. It's available on Amazon, either paper book or Kindle. And also, there's a Mars Society. It's an international Mars Society at marssociety.org. And there's the Mars Society Australia, which is at marssociety.org.au, and you can join and get involved with its activities.
Well, on that note, I must thank you for joining us on the space show.
Thanks for having me.